Okay, we have Ray O'Hanlon, friends, and I want to tell you a little bit about Ray O'Hanlon. He's a dub, through no fault of his own, and he got out of there when he could, and just in time to come to America. And he joined the Irish Echo newspaper, America's oldest Irish-American newspaper, in 1988. And as editor-in-chief, expanded coverage of... Well, first of all, let me welcome Ray. Thank you for getting up. All right. How are you doing there?
I'm fine, Adrian. Thank you.
Your career... did not start with the Irish Echo in New York. You were not only a recognized journalist, but a journalist in Ireland at a time when there was plenty of news and controversy in going on in Ireland, and you were in the thick of it there as a reporter. Can you maybe start there tell us what that scene was like?
Well, as you mentioned, my career in newspapers didn't start with the Echo. Actually started with a free weekly newspaper in South County, Dublin in 1979, a million years ago. But about 15 months later, I got a job with the Irish Press Group in Dublin and spent 7 years working at the press at its head office, its newsroom in Burkey by the River Liffey. And they were a wild 7 years, let me tell you. The 1980s was a restive and changing time in Ireland, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And I was a general pool reporter, which meant dealing with anything and everything. And I did. It was an extraordinary job. I was young and single at the time, and I went to every nook and cranny on the island of Ireland in the course of my work during that time. And it was terrific. I look back at it now very fondly, and I still mourn and lament the fact that the Irish press died in 1995 an extraordinary moment, actually, the final day of what was then the Bill Clinton trade conference on Ireland, and the news came from Dublin that it wasn't good, and what are you going to do? But it's an important point you make with regards to my work before, because and this kind of segues into coming here. As we all know, many, many young Irish were leaving Ireland in the mid-1980s and coming to the United States. And I wasn't very conscious of that in Ireland. I had a job, for starters.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people, it was down to individual families. But I don't remember any stories or many stories leaping out to me saying, huge numbers of our young people are quitting Ireland. And, you know, I mean, going to England was like, you know, like getting out of bed.
Yeah.
Going to America was a bigger deal. But it wasn't a front pager. And then it was only by coming here to the U.S., that I was able to look back and realize what was going on all around me, really, in the time that I was working as a reporter there. So it's sort of an irony in that, I suppose.
Yeah. It did. What was the level of awareness that you walked into when you came to New York? I asked that specifically because... you know, there were a lot of immigrants who had come here after the wake, as it were, of 1965, thereabouts, who were, you know, the immigration story, we were not jumping up and down, you know, or beating the bushes to draw attention, you know, to the fact that some of us were of the opinion we were the only ethnic group that were singled out for, you know, banishment. And but what was your awareness level, and how did you find that when you came here?
Yeah, no, I mean, when I came here, and obviously, and just for listeners, I came here because of my future wife, and my journey across the Atlantic wasn't because I had no job and I was looking for work. It was it was a personal thing, and I was going to get married, and we're still happily married all these years later. My wife's from the Midwest. She's from Chicago. Actually very quickly, because, and you will remember, and we're talking about 1987 now, the Irish who left Ireland quietly arrived in America rather more noisily. And very quickly they started to make noise based on the fact that they had come in on the wrong side of the amnesty provision in the 1986 Immigration and Control Act. And as you recall, they weren't happy with that, and they were somewhat amazed and surprised. And Irish Americans were somewhat amazed and surprised that this would be the situation that they faced. I think a lot of Irish Americans would sort of say, wait a minute, you know, the Irish are such a big part of America. We're part of the fabric, and so forth. How come these young Irish are facing into this situation of being illegal, undocumented? And it was they who started to make the noise, and I was still a reporter for the press. I was on leave of absence, and I obviously heard the noise. So initially, my work on immigration here was not for the Irish Echo, because I wasn't employed there in 87. I started to write stories for the Irish press. And I think it's fair to say that I sort of raised a story from America that was an Irish story in Ireland, too, for readers of that paper, that group's papers, there were three, from my new perch in New York. And I was learning about a story that originated where I came from that was now sort of making itself seen and felt in America. And so that those early days, I remember the earliest memory I have of doing this was sitting in an apartment in Brooklyn with a phone kind of tucked under my ear and top of my shoulder and a pen and notebook, and talking to Congressman Roman Mazzoli. You will remember him.
Yeah. I had forgotten.
Who is still with us. He's still alive. And Roman was, you know, he sounded like he should have been from Brooklyn, but he's actually from Kentucky. His district was, and Mazzoli, and he was working with Senator Alan Simpson at the time, the Republican. It was, you know, sort of a bipartisan thing. They were starting to look again at immigration because they were beginning to realize that the 86 Act hadn't dealt with all the situations. And that's my earliest memory. Of talking to Roman Mazzoli, and that would have been for the Irish press. So that would have been 87. And 88 is when I darkened the door of the Irish Echo and sort of brought the story with me. The Echo had already started reporting on this new phenomenon anyway. But obviously, when I arrived, I brought a very sort of a new angle to it, if you will, because I myself was Irish. And the story took off from there.
Were there a number of people who at the time said, why don't you leave well enough alone? Nobody is bothering them. Young immigrants that are coming here, they're continuing a tradition. They're great contributors to the country now. Why stirred the pot? Why shine that spotlight? So, O'Hanlon, why don't you leave well enough alone?
No, and I heard that, and I was literally remember the words being said by people to me, and it was sort of understandable. They would say, look, you know, we can look after them, you know, we can get them jobs. You know, we don't have to worry about it, you know, and they did, and they were getting jobs. I mean, they were coming here because they were getting work. You know, and I think a lot of them, they were young kids at the time. They were thinking, I'm not going to be here in America the rest of my life. I'll be here for a year, maybe two, make a bit of money, go back, get a kickstart in Ireland and so forth. A very natural sort of thing. And I was hearing this. Yeah, no, don't make a fuss. We'll look after the boys and girls. We'll get them jobs. And that was happening to an extent.
Yeah.
But I think what happened was that the numbers, would have been fine if the flow had stopped at a certain number, but it didn't. It kept getting bigger and bigger, and the ability to sort of absorb and look after them, they were harder to hide.
Yeah.
You know, as the numbers, and then the key thing was they themselves didn't want to stay quiet.
Yeah.
It was certain among the new arrivals who decided that this was an issue and they were going to let everybody hear about it.
Yeah, and I think, Ray, it would be fair to say that the new crowd, as they were known generally, they were more educated. They were they were coming in rather cheeky,
yeah.
and in fact, you know, their Irish American relatives were here. Had you know they had you know whereas they were welcome, but this was a new brand of yeah. Irish immigrant. You know, before that, you know, immigrants who came here were beholding to those who sponsored them and those who, you know, again, there were certain those criteria. If you were coming here as an immigrant, you know, you were supposed to at least, you know, be mannerly. And if those you came to were, you know, were Catholics and, you know, and if they were going to mass, whether you wanted to or not, you know, you kind of, you had to row in there and be respectful. And Irish Americans are saying, wait a minute, what's wrong with this crowd? They don't, half of them don't even go to mass. You know, I mean, there was a, something was happening. And yes, it was the quote young crowd that were coming in and they weren't looking for our advice at all.
No. No, the Irish of that time, the young Irish of that time, had been raised in a changing society, and they presented with, they had expectations. You know, they were Ireland was evolving, becoming more of a sort of a material consumer society. It wasn't the Ireland of the 60s, and certainly not the Ireland of the 50s.
Yeah.
And you know, they had expectations in life. They had been raised to believe that if they stuck with their education or got a good job and worked hard, that they could hold on to this job and look forward to sort of settling down in life. And that wasn't the case. And they weren't going to stay quiet about this. So yeah, they started to make a lot of noise. And Irish Americans at first were sort of somewhat aghast, and maybe a few were appalled. But the clamor sort of rose, and inevitably, what happened then was that, beyond the Irish American press, the main media, the main American media, began to hear this. And here was a very surprising story, that the Irish of all people were on the outs in terms of the American immigration system. So the story began to sort of manifest itself in the big media, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, all the way up to the New York Times and television and so forth and so on. And then, of course, they would journalists, American journalists, would, if they wanted sort of quick quotes and analysis, they would come to those of us working in the Irish American press. So the whole thing started to back and forth like a tennis ball a bit and grow. And all of a sudden you had a big story, you know, in the late, yeah. late end, towards the end of the 1980s.
You know, a lot has been written through the years, you know, about Ireland, and mostly, I think, the focus and the main media in America has been about Northern Ireland and the Troubles, and rightly so. And America obviously has had a great influence leading to the peace process and to, you know, to the George Mitchell influence and so forth. Is it possible that that topic kind of overshadowed, you know, that crown of thorns that was right in our faces at that time, saying, wait a minute, how did this happen in the first place? Why do we get on that list?
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, obviously the Troubles was the big story out of Ireland consistently through the 70s and 80s. And here was a different Irish story. And I'll tell you, the way that editors in any sort of media organization operate is that, you know, their eyes will grow a little bit jaded that, you know, here we have another Northern Ireland trouble story. You say, you know, we have a certain number of Irish stories a year, and that's inevitable. They have to be, you know, there's a lot of Irish people in America. And suddenly here was a very different story to the sort of somewhat careworn trouble story. And you say, wait a minute, what is all this about? And so it was no surprise, and as I recall, American journalists went hard at this new Irish story because it was a different story. It was a new story. It was unexpected. It was a surprise. It came out of left field. And, you know, so it became a sort of a big American story, as well as Irish-American and Irish. And of course, what that then does is start to pull in the politicians. And that was how it was happening then, as you know.
Yeah.
If you recall, in the late 80s, suddenly members, politicians at state, at local, at city, state, and federal level suddenly started to pay attention. So we had all the visa issuings of the late 80s and early 90s, which you remember because you were right in the thick of things, literally. At the time, and it became an ever bigger. It was a snowball going down a hill. It became a bigger and bigger story.
Yeah. You take us though, and I'm sure there still are people, you know, in Ireland. If we go back to the time that the door was slammed shut in America to the Irish, there were still a lot of homes in Ireland that had two pictures on the mantelpiece with the Sacred Heart lamp between the two of them. The other one, obviously, the picture of the Sacred Heart, particularly throughout rural Ireland, was indeed not only common but considered to be a must. And there we have whatever saint was sitting beside the main picture was taken down off the wall, and John F. Kennedy was there, way up on the same pedestal, so to speak. And in your book, you take a great swipe, you know, at the Kennedys, and you know. Many would say, why what's his beef this time?
No, I wouldn't say great swipe, Adrian. It's not. And this is, you know, I look back, you know, the 65 Act, and I remember in the 80s.
Yeah.
There was a lot of the focus was entirely on the consequences of the 86 Act. Not much talk about the 65 Act. The 65 Act came much more into the frame in the zeros, the 2000s, and the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform actions. And they were starting to look back beyond 86 backwards. Why are we still doing this? And more sort of eyes were cast back to 65. My book, Unintended Consequences, you know, obviously is planted now. Based very heavily on the 65 Act, which was largely, yes, a creation of President Kennedy, and after his assassination, his brothers, and particularly Teddy Kennedy, and then Lyndon Johnson, who sort of finally put everything together and sort of ushered the bill through Congress, signed it into law on Liberty Island in the summer of 65, and everything else. I look back at the 65 Act in different ways. I think it was in many ways a moral thing, a moral act. It was in the spirit of its times. It was, you know, in the time of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, it was an intent. They intended or hoped to make immigration to America more diverse, while at the same time they contradicted themselves. While politicians of the time didn't want to scare the hell out of American voters, saying it would make no difference at all to immigration people coming here. Ireland itself was changing, and the Irish were not taking up the quota to the same extent as they once was. So, you know, in a sense, there was no intended door closing. It was an unintended consequence. The Irish have never suffered. The only people to literally have the door shut in their face by the United States deliberately so were the Chinese in the 1880s.
Yeah.
Chinese Exclusion Act. No, but it's the unintended consequence of 65. It turned out absolutely very completely different to what a lot of people either believed or said they believed at the time, political leaders. And it changed America. I mean, I'm not analyzing everything here, but we have 11 million, 12 million undocumented people in the United States these days. You can probably root source that in the changes of the 65 Act. And the Irish are among them too. So I know I'm not so much swiping at the Kennedys, but I am sort of raising higher the Kennedy role. And of course, Teddy Kennedy, for years, for decades after that, felt bad about it. He tried to make it up, you know, to the Irish.
And a couple of times almost made it. He and getting John McCain, you know, on board too. But I'm dying to get at the part, you know, where Ireland was just aghast that Mr. Irish America was going to come to Ireland. And tell us about that, the meeting and the contribution indeed, if not the main source of, that little behind closed doors whisper in the air from De Valera. To John F. Kennedy, and how that, how that affected, or it wouldn't be fair to say led to, but in hindsight, particularly those who weren't Fianna Fáil or Dev fans in the first place, said, you know, that, the bloody Aegis there, he created all of this problem, and of course, obviously, the fact that Ireland and Dev and those, you know, wound up taking some of the blame for it and saying, why the hell did why didn't everything go well? And, you know, there was Kennedy in Ireland and talking about, you know, the huge contributions and past and present, you know, and then Ireland says, well, it's all right, but you're draining our brain, our young people. We're educating them. We'll send them over to you, and you didn't even say thanks, you know.
No, I mean, and they were making a valid point, I think, at the time, and it wasn't just De Valera. It was Sean Lamass and
absolutely
talking. De Valera was strictly speaking out of it at the time as president, but obviously still hugely influential. But no, that signal was being sent to the United States. It wasn't that they necessarily were involved in the crafting of the 65 Act. They weren't. And as I understand it, and a lot of the stuff is always, to some extent, it's hearsay. But as I understand it, Teddy Kennedy actually said to the Irish government, look, you know, we can do a set aside here, a little deal on the side of the Irish. Nobody knows. Blah, blah, blah. We have the new, every diverse immigration. No, thank you. We want to keep our people here. We want to develop our economy, which is absolutely understandable from that perspective on that side. The thing about it was, the way it ended up was, in a sense, the collision of two absolutes. We look at it today, and nobody in their right mind ever wants to see forced mass migration again from Ireland. We don't want to see that ever again. But neither do we want a continuation of a situation. And this is the point, this is kind of a bottom line to all this, where a young Irish man or woman wakes up in their bed on Monday morning and says, I've done this, this, and this, I've learned, I've been in this, whatever, I have this skill and that. I'd like to give it a go in America, see how it goes. Mm. And they can't do that simply because they are Irish. So that's the other extreme of it. You don't want mass immigration, but you don't want a complete shutout either. You want some sort of measured flow or a facilitation of choice, the great American thing, you know, that I could really do, you know, it'd be great if I go to America 5 years and do this, this, and that.
Or, yeah.
You know, but they can't do that. I mean, the only way an Irish person gets in now is if they win a visa lottery, a diversity visa lottery thing, which is like winning literally the lottery. The chances are minuscule. That you manage to lay hands on some sort of very specialized work visa, competing against the rest of the world, or you marry an American.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Do you say, by the way, do you remember once in a while, you know, particularly on Mother's Day, do you happen to, you know, on pillow talk, say to your wife, Lisa, thanks ever so much, you know, without you.
Yeah, well, you know, I was the original homeboy, Adrian.
I know.
I was quite happy, very happy. And, you know, I visited before I moved here full time. I'd been here three times.
Yeah.
82, 83, 86, and great times visiting America. And but I probably would have been happy with that life if, you know, I could have if I'd met an Irish girl over there and got married there.
Yeah.
It would have been all very different.
You're on dangerous territory there now. Try not to drag me down with you. Okay.
I know.
It's really.
And fate embraced me very well. Here I end up with this somewhat unplanned and unexpected American life, which is now more than half my life.
Mm.
I have passed that line where I've spent more than half my life in America. And, you know, it's been an extraordinary trip, to say the least. But I'm conscious all the time that how lucky I was.
Yeah.
You know, I was never on document.
Well, we all are, really, I think.
Yeah.
I think we're, and it does, I'm sure, dawn on all of us, well, where would we be if we were in Ireland? And the truth of the matter is that, you know, O'Hanlon's and Flannelly's and you know, many would say, you know, well, take a look at your siblings. Take a look at, they all did very well and whatever. But I think that what we need, you know, to acknowledge is that a lot of things we would not have learned about the grow that Irish Americans have for their homeland. We're way out front in terms of this draw to Ireland and the pride that we have from, you know, from our ancestors and what they accomplished. And yeah, we're absolutely fine, thank you. We wouldn't switch places with those who stayed at home and did very nicely and continue to do so.
Yeah, I find, and you know, with this book that I have now, Unintended Consequences, it's an Irish story and an American story.
Yes.
A story and an Irish story. And I find in the nature of my work over the years at times, I'm trying to explain America to people in Ireland. And trying to explain Ireland to people in America.
I know.
From this sort of, you know, sort of middle place. And, you know, I think that in Ireland, they have much to learn about their cousins in America, even now. And certainly, you know, the sort of the generation that shifted westward across the Atlantic and everything else. There is much to be learned there about the story here. And much to be learned here about the story there still.
Yeah.
And you and I both, in terms of our work, we kind of hover somewhere on a longitudinal line that maybe is sort of slightly west of Iceland or something. I don't know what it is. And looking this way and that. And, you know, when I was writing this book, I said at the outset, hold on, I'm going to use American spellings, okay? And I'm saying this to readers over there. You know, I used American spellings, which makes it slightly more an American book. But I'd be very curious to contrast the reaction of readers over there and readers over here.
Yeah.
And not necessarily Irish-born readers over here, but American-born readers over here and how they look at it. And, it, you know, it's I don't know, we'll see.
You, you know, much has been said, much more said than written, you know, about the closing of the door back in 1965. But I think that you have, you know, not harped on, you know, the immigration issue, but you get a trifecta in the sense that you take in, you know, politics and the culture as well. And it's a package. It wasn't all, you know, the immigration, you know, the closing of the door in 1965, yes, was tragic, but it wasn't just the Irish that were affected by it, but it did, and it was affecting our culture. You know, you take any of the contributions that we were making and the lifestyle that we had here, everything from, you know, from music and the language, the culture was fading. And we were looking around and saying, where are the Irish? Is it, what's going on here? But nothing much would have happened were it not for, you know, the political pressure that was there. And some would say, well, it paid them well to get in the board, but they didn't come rushing in the door.
No, the politicians.
Yeah.
No, they had to, you know, like all politicians, they had to be persuaded and pulled and tugged and pushed and cajoled. And but, you know, there were some who had to be less pushed and pulled than others.
Yeah.
There are heroes in this story, Congressman Brian Donnelly being one of them.
Amazing, yeah.
Bruce Morrison being another. Charles Schumer, who is not, obviously not Irish-American, but very knowledgeable and sort of attentive to Irish-American concerns. You know, there are a lot of politicians figure in the story as you go through for various reasons. And we have new ones now. It's more a sign of the times. Bob Menendez in the Senate, Linda Sanchez in the House of Representatives. But the Irish will get pulled along on this as well. But, of course, as we know these days, Congress can barely agree on what day of the week it is.
Oh, I know.
You know, what prospect for immigration reform right now? The bills are out there. They are completely comprehensive in every way and so forth and so on. But it's like you know, it's like a bombing raid. There's going to be a lot of anti-aircraft fire coming up from the ground. So, you know, it's, you're talking about entirely very personal family issues. The lives of people, the lives of families. I mean, in this immigration story, you can talk about the legislation, the politics, and all the rest of it. You've got to remember behind that are countless personal, individual stories. You'll never hear even a fraction of them, but they are there. They are very real. When you're writing something or talking about an issue like this, you have to remember always, why are you doing this? And you're doing it because there are just regular people out there whose lives have been affected, changed, pushed forward, pushed back by the actions or inactions of politicians and legislatures. And you should always remember them. That is why, for example, you know, am I writing this book for me? No. Am I writing this book for politicians? No. I'm writing it for the people who never get mentioned in the index, the countless people who are not in the index. They're the reason that a book like Unintended Consequences is written. They're the reason why you and I are talking about this.
Ray O'Hanlon, I remember many conversations along the way with the book, and I would, you know, prompt you and ask you, hey, what's holding you up there, fella? And maybe if we go back to your, you know, initial impulse to write a book, which is Unintended Consequences, did you had a lot of information, you had done a lot of research, you're a historian, But was there, how did you come up with, and I mean, it might be, you know, layman's question, but at what point did you figure that you were going to weave this story into, you know, what at the end of the day, you know, turned out to be 300-some-odd pages, that, you know, your editor, your publisher was saying, excuse me, fellow, are you coming through with this and that? But it is the most comprehensive story that takes us right through, and it's excellent. And you know, considering your other books won many awards, this one I think it opens doors that we had no idea were there. There were so many aspects, you know, to this, and again the unintended consequences is it's a great read, and it is the story of Irish immigration to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And again, for once and for all, you do give us, you know, a starting point where many times, you know, without sometimes talking through our hats, we say, oh, well, something happened back in 1965. And it's quite easy to add on to that, and particularly in barroom talk, to say if it wasn't for the, you know, De Valera and Lemass, and you know, there wouldn't be any, Immigration Act, and Lyndon Johnson wouldn't even have bothered, and the Kennedys and the whole lot of them.
Yeah.
Where that's easy for us. But actually, at the end of the day, this was going to happen. It wasn't an anti-Irish movement at all.
No.
And you spelled that out for us.
Well, yeah. No, I mean, if you as you'll recall, back in 1998, I had a book, The New Irish Americans.
Yes.
It dealt in part with the 80s and the 90s and the immigration actions at the time and the Irish immigration reform movement and you know, the various visa lotteries, and it sort of reached an end in 1998 when things are improving dramatically in Ireland, and it looked like, well, we're all settled now. But then years down the line, and it becomes apparent that, for example, even though over 70,000 people got various visas, there were still thousands of undocumented Irish, and we won't talk about the numbers. You could talk all day. But the story continued. You had the Irish Lobby for Immigration Reform. And then what happened, and I'm looking at this, and I'm sort of thinking, well, should I extend and rewrite The New Irish Americans or something? And then I get what lands in my email is the written testimony, if you will, of Judge John Collins, a New York jurist who is an absolutely pivotal figure in this story. A kickstarter, and he is writing essentially his personal testimony in relation to the work of the American Irish National Immigration Committee from the late 60s, early 70s, and post-65 Act.
Right.
He presents this, and I read this, and I say, oh, boy, this is something that predates me by a long way and really is the basis for what happened in the 80s and 90s and what is happening now. And I said, wait a minute, this is an entirely new story. Well, what you have, it's like you had a movie in The New Irish Americans is like a movie, and then you have, I could write a sequel. Now I'm going to write a prequel and a sequel and string the whole thing together. And then I sort of said, well, wait a minute, even before 65, why was 65 seen as such a betrayal? You have to go back before 65 to tell the story of the Irish in America. So the thing gets bigger and bigger. And if you look at, there's a lot of chapters in this book, and I kind of look at chapters, they're like individual pearls, and you kind of have to string them all together to get a string of pearls.
Yeah.
And the book is a kind of a string of pearls. And I actually mention the very first recorded Irishman on the North American continent in this book, a gentleman by the name of Edward Nugent, who landed off a British ship off Virginia, marched inland, supposedly got into a fight with a local chieftain, killed a guy, and that was the first Irish action in North America. It wasn't very positive, and And I sort of laughed at it. I thought, I've got to put this story of Edward Nugent in, because I had an uncle by the name of Edward Nugent. I did.
Really?
And, yeah, he was from Cork. And I said, I got to get Eddie Nugent in here one way. So that, the story starts to go back. And if you look at this thing, there's a couple of chapters. There are a number of chapters that are underlining the connection, the deep, deep connection, the sentiment, the sentimental and the bonds between Irish and America. The chapter on the Irish cadets at Kennedy's funeral, the chapter on Annie Moore.
Yeah.
Various other chapters dealing with Irish and Irish Americans serving in Vietnam, for example, and their experiences. So, you know, if nothing had happened before 65, if the Irish had been minuscule in the American story, only a little sideshow, what would you say? I mean, what were you betraying? But you have to set it up. You have to say 65 flew in the face of an extraordinary story before it, an extraordinary history and an extraordinary connection between an island of Western Europe and a new country growing in the New World. And then you realize the sense of betrayal that existed among some post-65, even if it was unintended. Because you can say, well, unintended is just damn careless as well. What have you done? After all we've done, what have you done to us? So the story becomes a sort of a narrative, a sort of a long tale, a long form tale of the Irish story in America. But then obviously in particular deals with the work of AINIC, IRM, ILIR, the Ancient Order of Hibernians in there, obviously right through the whole thing there, a sort of a thread right through the whole story. Up to the present time. Now, as you're aware, this book was supposed to be published last year.
Yep.
And COVID kind of, you know, delayed everything. So it was published a little later. It was actually able to mention at the beginning and on the cover, you know, the fact that the most self-consciously Irish-American president in American history, Joe Biden, is now the president of the United States. He wears his Irishness on his sleeve even more than JFK. So we were able to do that. The book is being published now, I think 26th of April, I think. And
Yeah.
But the story continues.
Yeah. It's actually, did Ireland get to jump on this one? Is it available in Ireland? Or?
Yeah, they did a little bit, because it is being printed on both sides of the Atlantic, hopefully enough. Ireland's a little bit ahead of the game. We're ahead of the game in vaccines, so, you know, let's stick to our priorities here. But no, it's being printed in Chicago as well, and there was a bit of a sort of backlog.
Yeah,
I was told kind of COVID related, and so the publication date was going to be February, March, and then it was blah blah blah. Now it's Amazon that decides. You know, publishers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
Amazon decides everything now, and Amazon decides when it actually physically exists. It is the publication. They wait till the book physically exists before they declare the official publication date. And on their website, they have it down. They have a publication date of April 6th, but then when you read to the side, it says available April 26th.
Right. Okay.
I'm taking that. Yeah, I mean, to confuse you even more, I'm taking April 26th as the official publication date in the United States, everywhere. So.
Just in case there are listeners who feel that there have been so many false starts, false hopes, you know, and sending up another flare to say, you know, and rubbing our hands together and say, oh, you know, Biden now is very Irish happy, and he's, you know, he has Ireland in his craw. He'll take care of everything. You know, if you're an undocumented immigrant, but particularly an Irish immigrant, who over and over again listen to the Ray O'Hanlons and the Flannelys and the everybody else saying, this time I think maybe we've got it. And then it turns out to be like a total flop. Just give us, if you will, Ray O'Hanlon, because you have, you have indeed, you have an obsession if I may say so, of you know, the Irish immigration and the number of stumbling blocks and so forth. Is it real at this stage of the game to expect, with Congress and no two people in Washington, you know, talking to one another, how real is it that you think something can happen now in this continuing story?
Yeah, I always remember the line from Ronald Reagan, actually, trust but verify. And I trust that Senator Menendez and Congresswoman Sanchez are absolutely sincere and dedicated to pushing through comprehensive immigration reform. But before I start jumping up and down and celebrating, I have to verify the realities on Capitol Hill. And as always, they are murky, to say the least. You know, but look, better there's something there than nothing.
Absolutely. And also, I think better, you know, that particularly at a time, you know, for years and years, the, you know, the immigrant story, you know, the was focused, and indeed through, particularly through Trump, through that his presidency, is immigrant is a dirty word. Mm. And it doesn't matter from whence you come. You know, just keep it out here. When in fact, the reality was that the Trumps of this world were talking primarily about Mexico and South America and whatever. But there's a sour taste, and I think you would acknowledge that, Ray O'Hanlon, there's a sour taste attached to immigrants in general. You know, yeah. And we have to over. Come that, and we can't obviously do it on our own. So, the task ahead for President Biden.
It's no small thing.
No.
And there always has been a sour taste. I mean, the contradiction of America. There's always the Statue of Liberty version.
Yeah.
Immigration. And then there's the Gangs of New York version, not very far away from it, of immigration. And, you know, it's always been a battle back and forth. There's nothing new in that. You know, we don't meet on the streets of early Manhattan these days and fight with meat cleavers and swords.
Oh,
and
I know.
They fight with words under the dome of the Capitol. And, you know, but the result can be just as negative towards immigrants at the end of the day. So it is pretty much a constant sort of battle, I suppose, if you will. But as I said, there is you know, the skin in the game now. There are the bills, and there is there have been sympathetic presidents before. I mean, Barack Obama would have signed
absolutely
the 2013 Gang of Eight bill. George W. Bush would have signed signed McCain Kennedy. The presidents have not been, well, you mentioned Trump, maybe would have been a bit of a problem in terms of signing, but who knows with Trump? You get him on a good day, he might have been quite happy to have the cameras in as he signed some form of immigration bill. We'll never know. But by and large, presidents have not been, they have neither been the deciding factor or the problem. It really is in the Congress that where we have to pay attention.
Well, the book, Unintended Consequences, friends, I don't think anybody can pick up this book, particularly the know-it-alls like some of us, without wondering where we were and how did we miss out on, you know, some of the chapters in this in your book. I have every confidence that this is going to be amazing, and it's educational. And it's a book that, you know, we can all highly recommend it. Not that indeed you're short at all of plenty of endorsements, you know, for the book from very prominent, you know, writers and authors. We want to wish you luck with it, but I think we're going to hear a lot more, you know. But great starting point is Unintended Consequences. Are you kind of pushing the Amazon as a means, because it's got, this is when bookstores do open, this is going to be, you know, and how is that for an author, like for yourself? Okay, pandemic came, this is not a good time, we'll put it off for a little bit, and so forth. Yeah. At the end of the day, is Amazon the end-all and the be-all of books and distribution?
No, I like to think, I mean, obviously they are pivotal. BarnesandNoble.com, but if you look, right. if you look up the book on online, there's all sorts of online booksellers. And I had a friend, it was funny enough, in San Francisco the other day, and she was, I was talking to her, and I said, "Well, are you getting the book?" She says, "I absolutely, but I'm not going to get it from Amazon." She says, "I don't like Amazon." So I said, "Well, fine." Mm-hmm. So she went to her local bookstore, which was open, and they put in an order. So you can certainly go to your local bookstore.
Oh, boy. You might have to wait, I didn't know longer, that, by the way. Yeah.
If they don't have it now, I'm trying to find out. Certainly in Ireland, you'll see it in bookstores. I hope it's in Barnes & Noble here or our local bookstores.
Yeah.
But you can always go. Local bookstores are like mini Amazons as well. If they don't have it in stock, they will order it for you.
Yeah,
they will. And so if you ask, they will do it. So, you know, I like the idea of that sort of the local bookstore.
Yeah,
getting first attention, if you will. But of course, you know, Amazon is the 10,000-pound gorilla in the room, and you can't ignore it. Love it, hate it, but you can't ignore it, sort of thing. But I also like the idea of people going to their local bookstore and putting an order, and while they're in the bookstore making the order, buying another book as well.
And absolutely, and you know, bookstores are actually opening. There are a lot of cobwebs in some of them that have to be, you know, removed, but they are opening up, and not just for Ray O'Hanlon's book, Unintended Consequences, but I think a lot of people, we need to get the bookstores to meander, and that's a big part of what we're missing as well. You know?
Yeah.
Thank you, Ray. This is an incredible book, and I have every confidence that it's going to do very well. Ray?
I hope so.
Thanks. Okay?
Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, indeed. And we'll read more about one last thing I want to mention is that the Irish Echo, oldest newspaper, is a weekly newspaper. However, the Irish Echo is, and the stories are, you know, you can, every day of the week, you can access the Irish Echo. Tell us about the digital aspect of that.
Well, this is one thing that has changed dramatically since I started the newspaper business way back in the day on manual typewriter. Now, I mean, the Echo comes to you print, online, digital, e-zine, you know, and any which way you can think. And that is one thing that has changed enormously, our ability to communicate instantly and over any distance. And also that's just to make a point for all, for Irish American organizations too.
Yeah.
I think that has become a lifeline for Irish America is the internet, social media. And all has changed utterly, to borrow from Mr. Yeats.
Yeah. Thank you, Ray O'Hanlon.
Thank you, Adrian,
finally. And, friends, he's an amazing guy and a great writer, author, and he, if we owe anybody, you know, a debt of gratitude for his gnawing at, you know, since going back since the day he arrived in the United States, coverage of immigration and keeping the immigration issue alive. Okay, it'd be hard to beat Ray O'Hanlon. Unintended Consequences. And friends,